So the topic tonight is your meditation working, and it actually seems kind of like a weird topic to me, because as I wrote it down, I thought, what does that even mean? What does working mean? How would we define working? So with that said, how many people think their meditation needs some adjustment, needs some working on? Raise your hand. Oh, well, maybe it is a good topic. All right, because I mentor a number of people and talk to them, and this seems to be a topic of conversation. And different people need different tuning up, you know, depending on a lot of variables. So one of the first things we ask is, what is our aim for our practice? Why are we practicing? So again, I'm going to stop for a moment, and anybody want to share, why are you practicing? Why are you sitting quietly for 40 minutes at least once a week, and probably more than that? Yeah.
I ask, you get many stories going on up here, and the one that I hate is the one that says, what are you doing? Why are you sitting here?
Yep.
This is stupid. And I hate that one, you know. And all these people are sitting here.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, what's the point?
Exactly.
And, but, it's, you know, I can't really put it into words, but there's got to be something to sit and, I mean, it's not really fun. It's confronting self, which is not always pretty.
Mm-hmm.
But there's something about it. Something, I don't know what it is, but I keep coming back. So whatever that something about it is,
right.
Sometimes it can be quite torturous on a retreat.
Mm-hmm.
Dang, I want out of here now. And I go back the next year for more.
That's right.
So
isn't that interesting?
Yeah, I don't know what it is, but there's something.
Yeah.
Something.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah.
I find that it puts a little bit, when I can get there, it puts a little more space between the thoughts.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, that whole monkey mind thing is a very, very common attribute that I have. So it's, I get the opportunity sometimes to just step out of the insanity for just,
mm-hmm.
you know.
Right.
Like a split second.
You're both kind of saying the same thing, just in a different way. Not sure why I'm doing this. It might be stepping outside of the insanity for a little bit, even though you're looking at the insanity. It's just flipping it around. So, yeah, John.
To tame my inner demons. Mm.
So, good. Excellent. Yeah, Chris.
I meditate so that I can face whatever life throws at me with some measure of equanimity.
Mm-hmm.
This might be an interesting way of saying equanimity, but to flatten out my emotional roller coaster.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Yeah. Learning about myself.
Good. All right.
So why is stepping back for a little bit and not being so entangled at the things that life just keeps throwing at you, often really unpredictably.
Yes. Yeah.
Well, I guess the big picture is to suffer less and to behave in ways that don't create suffering as much in other people.
Mm-hmm. Well put. Very well put. So that's what we're going to discuss a little bit. And I just had my own opportunity to look at this. I did a solo retreat for 12 days, stopped last Tuesday. And when I went into the solo retreat, it just means having a retreat at your house and listening to Dharma talks in the evening. And just like a retreat, you just have to be patient with yourself. And looking at what you want to do versus what you should be doing. Anyway, on this retreat, I was very much looking forward to it because I had done this a year and a half ago, and for a month, and had this fantastic retreat with all these spiritual goodies and lucid dreams. Ooh, this is so cool. This is the way it should be, you know, that kind of thing that occasionally happens. So I thought, well, good, I'm going to go back to that place. You know what that means as soon as you do that. That is not the place you're going back to. You can guarantee it. But I forgot. I totally forgot. And what I had to look at was, first of all, my mind state was in a completely different place. I'd gone through a lot of issues, family issues, and I hadn't realized, and I bet a lot of you have seen this as well, how deeply embedded it was until you sit for a while, and then you realize how much it is really just part of your body, your mind and your body. And the first couple days, as I was talking to someone earlier, and as you said, were torturous. This isn't what I want. This is not it at all. And I'm living in my house. I can just quit doing this. I can stop right now if I want to. But I didn't, just like you mentioned. You know that there's something going on, and you're curious, and you want to find out, and you want to uproot it and do the best you can, even though it can be torturous. And I also appreciate the bliss of solitude, even when perhaps meditation is not going so well, and I'm going to talk more about that. Just getting away from it all. Maybe not even meditating, just not having to answer the phone, not have to deal with emails, having no obligations, having to be someplace. That alone was, you know, a gift. So I do studying when I'm on retreat. I have regular sitting periods, and then I have study periods, and I especially like reading suttas. And I read this one sutta. It's called the Magyia Sutta. And I'm going to tell you a little bit about it because it goes into meditation. It goes into why are we and what is skillful and what should we be doing to have a more skillful solo meditation. When I say solo, I mean sitting by yourself in your house or doing a solo retreat. So Magyia was an early attendant of the Buddha, and he would accompany the Buddha as the Buddha went around giving Dharma talks, and they went through this beautiful mango grove, absolutely gorgeous, and Magyia said to the Buddha, you know, it would be really great if I came back to this beautiful mango grove and just sat here for a day. That would be great. That would really up my practice. And the Buddha said, obviously I'm paraphrasing, the Buddha said, I don't think so. And so Magyia goes, all right. And they walk a little bit further, and then he says, you know, I've been thinking about that mango grove and how beautiful it is. I really want to go back there and sit. And the Buddha goes, I don't think so. I don't think you should do that right now. So Magyia, I imagine, is rolling his eyes and, you know, when is he going to let me go do my practice? They go further and he asks a third time. And as you know, the tradition is if you ask a Buddha something three times, the third time he'll say okay. I'm not quite sure why that is, but that's the way it is. And so he asked a third time and the Buddha said, well, if you think it's going to be helpful, you know, for your ultimate freedom, go and sit in the mango grove. So with that setting, I'm going to read what happens next. Now, while Venerable Magyia was staying in the mango grove, he was for the most part assailed by three kinds of unskillful thoughts. Thoughts of sensuality, thoughts of ill will, and thoughts of doing harm. In other words, he was going insane, like we all see that happens when the thoughts are just spinning around. And the thought occurred to him, how amazing. This is astonishing. Even though it was through faith that I went forth from home to the homeless life, still I am overpowered by these three kinds of unskillful thoughts, of sensuality, ill will, and the thought of doing harm. So he goes back to the Buddha and tells him, well, you apparently were right. I'm not doing so well on this solo path. And the Buddha then gives him a lesson, and I think it's an important lesson for all of us, especially people who are starting out. And he says, Migya, in one whose awareness release is still immature, five qualities bring it to maturity. Which five? And this is a progressive list, starting with something and then ending with something. And the first thing he says is, there is a case where a bhikkhu has admirable people as friends, companions, and colleagues. It's the first thing. Very first thing he said, hanging out and being with people who have admirable qualities. A sangha, in other words. And then he goes, furthermore, the monk is virtuous. He dwells restrained in accordance with the Padamokkha, which is the rules of monks and nuns, consummate in his behavior and range of activity. So secondly, he's talking about virtuous activity. You know, he said it elsewhere. You know, the Noble Eightfold Path follows this, but this is explicit advice. So virtuous activity is next. Before you even begin a meditation practice, hang out with people who are going to be supportive and start looking at your conduct in life. Furthermore, he gets to hear at will easily and without difficulty talk that is truly sobering and conducive to the opening of awareness. So he's saying, go to a Dharma center. Go listen to some Dharma talks. Start opening your mind to what is possible. So far, nothing about meditation. This is all leading up to a meditation practice. And then, now he gets into it. Furthermore, he begins his meditation being persistent about the arousing of and abandoning unskillful mental qualities and for taking unskillful qualities. So this could be the hindrances, it could be cultivating the Brahma Viharas, all the things that we teach and do courses on here. And then finally, the very last thing is, furthermore, he is discerning, he's endowed with discernment relating to the arising and passing away, noble, penetrating, leading to the right ending of stress, seeing the impermanence of everything. You know, nice little foray into what should be done. And it reminds, did anybody go to Tony's talk here, I guess, last week? Did he mention the one-fold path? He often mentions that, you know, mindfulness being what is taught, you know, in the secular setting. And Tony says, you know, the one-fold path doesn't work. That's only eighth or seventh of the Noble Eightfold Paths is right mindfulness. And that's pretty much what the Buddha is saying here, too. You've got to start with a lot of other things before you get serious about your meditation practice. So it goes back to, I came up with some qualities for evaluation. I looked at a paper that Gil had written and then some other things and some of my own reflections. And the first is intention, and we already mentioned this, why are you practicing? And the most important thing in this is honesty. Is honesty. And those of us who go into prison, it's the first thing I ask new prisoners. And the reason is because very often they are not very honest because they want to please you. They want you to think they're really noble and really looking for enlightenment or whatever. And often it's just they want to get out of their cell. They're bored. And I so appreciate if someone actually says, I'm bored and I want out of my cell. To me, that's refreshing. That is something you can work with. But if somebody has this attitude of, I'm going to be enlightened and I'm going to show you how well I'm doing, they've just created a self. They've created a self that now they're going to have to tear down to get any place. So it's kind of just another way of saying, beginner's mind, you know. Not sure why I'm here. I'm open to what's going to be taking place. So in the Buddha's time and in our time, there were two strands of intention. One of them was, and this was most of the time for lay people, was ease of life, to have an ease of being, to be happier in your home life or whatever was taking place in your life. And for monastics, what do you think their intention was?
Liberation.
That's right. Complete, ultimate liberation. It's very, very interesting. The other book I had read, and I'd read it once already, but I really got to spend time with it, is this one by Gil Fronsdale, The Buddha Before Buddhism. And he translates one of the very earliest discourses. It's called the Atthakavagga. It's considered one of the earliest, and if not the earliest. And it's very interesting. Those two strands that I told you about, lay people, you know, wanted their life to be more enjoyable, to get along with everybody, and monastics wanted transcendence. That didn't happen in early Buddhism. That wasn't there. The goal was to be at peace. Very interesting how that turns into transcendence. And Gil makes the argument that the Buddha himself calls himself a person of peace, a person who's comfortable in the world. And maybe that's what we're trying to do, all of us, that might lead to this ultimate state of ultimate comfort and relaxation and being okay with the way things are. So there's those two strands, and I think they're both doable following what the Buddha had told Migya. Also think, if we have modest goals versus the transcendent goal, anything is possible. But starting with, say, the five training precepts. I've taught many courses, both in prison and in this Sangha, on the five training precepts. And Susan and Orr and I taught a course on five precepts and climate change. You know, for my money, focusing on the five precepts encompasses so much of the path that it can get you so far. If you consider the way you are in the world and you do not want to harm living beings, what does that say about your practice? The very first precept, I train in not harming living beings. That to me is just about there. If that's where you get, where you no longer want to harm, it's huge. And then the other four just break it down into not wanting to take things that aren't given, being sexually responsible, being truthful, and avoiding intoxicants that cloud the mind. Wow, what if we all did that all the time? You know, and that's considered the beginning of the path, the very beginning. And it's huge. So small, I'm going to say modest goals. I think that's a huge goal, but that is considered the beginning of the path. Generosity, and then the five training precepts. And then we have realistic goals. You know, I mentor people, and so many people say, especially when they're starting, I can't do this. I can't sit for 15 minutes. I just can't stand it. Yeah, I just want to get up. Okay, what would your advice be to a person who says that? They really want a meditation practice, but they say, I just can't stay there for 15 minutes. I've got to leave. What would your advice be to them?
3 minutes. Start for 5 minutes.
I think that's good advice. That's good advice. Anybody else?
Walking meditation.
That's another piece of advice, and we'll go into that a little bit. Actually, what we should be saying to someone who can't sit for 15 minutes is, that's your practice, to actually investigate what is going on, what's happening. Look at everything about those 15 minutes and what's taking place, and especially in the body. You know, the first foundation of mindfulness is being with the body. So where is it? Where is it located? Where do you feel it the most? What does that do to the mind? if somebody is sincere about a practice, they will stay with that. And I don't, I've also told people this, and I'm sure most of you, because you have mostly been practicing for quite a while. In my own meditation, I sit for 45 minutes a day, regularly, sometimes twice a day. The first 15 minutes, still, after 20, 25 years, are insane. They're insane. There's no settling down. It's just all over. But the difference is, I totally expect it now. It doesn't bother me any longer. I don't judge myself on it. It's just the way it is. And I know after 15 minutes, it's going to start to settle down. I even timed myself on a number of occasions, looking over, yep, it's settling down, 15 minutes, okay. And this is why a lot of teachers will say, if you're only going to sit for 15 or 20 minutes, you're going to be very frustrated, because all you're going to get is the insanity. You'll see the insanity, but you're not going to get the calming that takes place. So that's why investigating that first 15 minutes, and if you can do that, if you can just get interested, the next 15 minutes are going to go much better. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Oh, yeah, Ajahn Amaro, and I've quoted him many times, said, learning meditation is learning that you are insane. And I love that. And he said, only arhants are not insane. So welcome to the world of insanity, and good luck, and just keep plugging away, because it will get better. And it does. You know. I wanted to talk a little bit about, some people have explicit goals, like jhana practice. And experiencing the jhana. Does everybody know what the jhanas are? Okay. The jhanas are very, very concentrated states of mind. And there are actually retreats where the whole practice is to cultivate these very concentrated states of mind. There's traditionally eight. Four are lower level, and there's the four higher jhana states. I know when I first started practicing, that was one of my goals. I really worked at it. Really, really worked at it. And achieved some success, but really started wondering, well, that was fun, but is this all there is? And the Buddha said, no, it isn't. And if this is your goal in practice, you're going to be disappointed, because insight doesn't happen with the jhanas. It's a pleasant state of mind. It can help get you to insight if you happen to have that kind of mind. And as any teacher will tell you, there are some people who will never get into a jhanic state. They don't have, physiologically perhaps, the wherewithal to do that. But anybody can meditate. Anybody can be relaxed. Anybody can have insight arise. It just comes in different forms. So for, especially when I first started practicing in this tradition 20 years ago, we had what were called, and some of you might remember this, the jhana wars. Anybody remember the jhana wars? Well, this was when people were practicing so hard with the jhanas, they were actually comparing their different states of mind to see who was having the more spiritual goodies. I went to one retreat many years ago, and at the end, and it was a concentration retreat, and at the end of the retreat, one of the people said, well, we're going to have groups get together so we can all periodically get together and share our jhanic experiences. That didn't ring so skillful to me, and didn't join it. In fact, kind of lost interest in that whole goal, because perhaps you can see it's creating another self. It's the jhanic self. It's the judgment about yourself and others, just at a different state of mind. It's not helpful. However, if people are sincere in doing jhanic practice for a reason, and not for a goal, but to actually experience it, that's something different. And only you can decide that for yourself, if that's your intention. Going back to intention. Another thing we need to look at with our meditation practice is evaluating your present life situation. How many just think they're too busy? They just don't have time to have a regular sitting practice. Be honest. Who thinks that? Oh, some awkward little... There's nothing wrong with that. You might be too busy and you just can't develop a regular sitting practice. That's okay. It really is okay. The point is, can you be honest about it and not flagellate yourself going, I'm a bad meditator. get together with friends and they're talking about their practice and you don't want to say anything because you're a bad meditator. This is also creating a self, and it's not helpful. It's not helpful at all. You sit when you can. You do what you can to the best of your ability. Go back to Magia and what the Buddha told him. Have friends. Have spiritual friends. Maybe that's an important part of your practice, is speaking to others about what's going on. Cultivate virtue. Come to Dharma talks. That's good. That's good. And that will lead to maybe more meditation and maybe not. But you're starting down the path. You're continuing down the path. I am going to again put in a plug for, I gotta check the time, solitude. For many people who say they can't meditate, I have told this so many times, okay, don't meditate, but be quiet. Just be quiet. Go someplace and turn everything off. You can even read a book. You can listen to chants or some kind of relaxing music. But you're not engaging in Facebook, you're not Twittering, you're not emailing, you're not doing any of that stuff. You're not talking on the phone. You're being as quiet as you can. That's it. And if you do that once a week for 4 or 5 hours, I guarantee you will start meditating. Guarantee it. You won't even have to try. You're just going to appreciate the solitude and want to go to the next step. It happens automatically. Eventually, you're just going to say, you know, I love this chanting, but I think I'm just going to turn it down. Sit out in nature. If you are lucky enough to have a backyard, sit in your backyard and just observe some leaves or the birds or clouds going by. That's it. Don't meditate. Just do that. It'll make a world of difference. So if you have a meditation practice, does it match who you are? You know, many times people have read a book and go, ooh, that sounds so good. I'm going to start doing that. I've done that. Anybody else done that? So inspired by that book. I had some of the weirdest meditation practices you can imagine. I'm not even going to confess them to you, but I read books and go, ooh, that's good. That's really good. Huh?
Tell us one.
No, I am not. I am not. I bear enough in here. I'm not going to go into that. Also, you know, if you go to a teacher, and this has happened to many of us, and be aware of this, teachers are not infallible. I'm certainly not infallible. Dennis and Rich aren't infallible. Gil Fronsdale's not infallible. You might get advice that isn't good for you. That doesn't work. It might not work. But who can tell if that's working or not? You. That's it. You know, we don't know how what's going on in your life or the intricacies of your disposition. You have to decide, is this working or not? Maybe a teacher would say, I really think you should be doing some concentration work, you know, from what you've told me. And maybe you haven't told the whole story and you try it and you're just not, it's not working for you. Okay. Then that's what you work with. That's not working. I got to try something else. Be willing to move around a bit. Go back to solitude. Try walking meditation. something else might work. Also, different states of mind, and I'm going to go into this right now. How many people, when they sit, do they actually say to themselves, what is your mental state right now? Do that? From my point of view, I think that's one of the most important things you can do. When you sit, actually gauge, what is my state of mind? This is the third foundation of the four foundations of mindfulness, and very rarely do people do it. And when they do it, they often lie to themselves. Because I don't want to feel like that. So I'm just going to say, no, I'm not. Again, another reason I absolutely love going into prison and giving these same kind of talks is they will experiment with this. And when we do our go rounds, and I'll say, I'd like you to describe your mind state, and I want you to be absolutely honest. Just like, why are you here? Being absolutely honest. Well, what is your mind state now? Again, if I don't give that directive, it will be, oh, I have so much peace. I just feel in bliss. You know, oh, give me a break. No, you don't. Not everybody in this room is blissful, which is what it used to be like. And now that it's okay to say exactly what's taking place, people are very honest. I'm upset. I got a phone call right before I came in, and my mind is upset. I'm really happy. This sit was really good for me. You know, just honesty. And why this is important? First of all, it's the filter for your meditation. It's how your meditation is going to be seen. Going through that filter of your mind state. It's also the filter of when you talk to someone else later. It's the filter of how you are hearing them and how you are expressing yourself. That's the mind state right now. So it's always important to actually sit down and look at it. And it's not easy to do. It's another meditation technique. You actually have to sit and look at it. I did this a few times when I was on this retreat, and I thought, I really got a deep sadness, and I didn't realize it. And where is this from? And I pinpointed where it came from and didn't go into the storyline. Oh, that's it. That's what happened. Okay, now I know. This is what's taking place right now, and it will too pass. But right now, there's sadness. And sadness will go away. And I'll gauge it the next time. Also, do you know how you learn best? The Dharma talks I listened to were mostly Stephen Batchelor. Does everybody know who Stephen Batchelor is? He's a great favorite of many of us. He wrote a wonderful book called After Buddhism. He also wrote Confessions of a Buddhist Atheist. He was a monk for many years, then became a monk in the Zen tradition, and is now spending a lot of time in Barre, Massachusetts, in the Theravadan tradition. So he's, you know, got the full gambit. I listened to a number of talks by him, and one of the things he talked about was the varieties of meditation experience. You know, when the Buddhaghosa was a commentarian who lived 500 years after the Buddha, and he put together what's called the Visuddhimagga, and the Visuddhimagga compiles all the Buddhist teachings, all those lists that we have. Thank Buddhaghosa for that. Mm-hmm. He put them together. And some of them are quite annoying. Some are just extensive. But there's one interesting thing that Stephen Batchelor had mentioned that I've thought about a lot prior to even this talk, was the Buddha taught 40 different meditation techniques, 40 of them. And being a skillful teacher, he knew what you should be doing at this point in your life. And it would change, you know, depending on where you are. A skilled teacher, probably a monastic would be able to do that with you. I mean, somebody who's really, their life is devoted to this. I don't think too, my own experience, I don't think too many lay teachers would know all 40 possible meditation techniques. The Buddha said that out of those 40, though, there's three that are appropriate for everybody. And that's anapanasati, which is mindfulness of breathing, metta, boundless friendliness, and maranasati, mindfulness of death. Mindfulness of death. And it almost seems to me it's your whole life there, you know, beginning with your breathing. Living a life not wishing harm, wishing benevolence on all living beings, and then mindfulness at your own death. I mean, that's the way I look at it. It makes sense to me. But he also talked about, he gave a talk, it's called The Aesthetics of Emptiness. I love that title. I mean, he's, you know, he's such a scholar, and The Aesthetics of Emptiness. And he said what he found out for himself, one of the meditation techniques that he loves, is art. And he said in the Theravadan tradition, it's not emphasized so much. He's actually starting a study of art at Barry Center in Massachusetts, Theravadan Center. And he said what he found, and perhaps those of you who do artwork, the self gets out of the way when he gets totally engrossed in a piece of art. And he does collages. He also said he found when he writes his books, he said, I'm not writing them. Somehow words are just coming out. I don't know where they're coming from because the self has gotten out of the way. I do some artwork and I understand that, and that relief that comes doing art. Again, this isn't for everybody, but those of you who are more creative might have found this to be true. Noticing when the self gets out of the way. Meditation doesn't have to be just formal sitting, although I think it's extremely helpful. You might find for your particular personality, something else might get the self out of the way, because that's the ultimate goal, is to not be selfing. He gave another talk, it was on the aesthetics of emptiness. And it also went into the same thing. I'm sorry, that was the same talk. He gave another talk, and it was the emptiness of care. And he spoke about how important it is. Another pretty much way of life is, how much do you care for other sentient beings other than yourself? That's another way of getting the self out of the way. You can see where this is going. Trying to not be obsessed with self. The first of the fetters that has to drop away for liberation is self-identity. Self-identity. And if any of you were surveyed, and we all were very, very confessional, we would admit our worst times have always been obsession with self and what's happening with self. And that is why the third of the characteristics of life, anatta, being empty of self, is a relief. All meditation is trying to get us to that point where we realize we are just part of something so much bigger. We are interconnected. To take ourselves so seriously causes suffering. And we all know that. I want to, how much time do I have? I'm going to close very soon, but I'm going to tell you this one because it was just such a sweet story. One of the other things that Stephen Batchelor talked about, meditation in everyday life, well, this is mindfulness. You know, it's being mindful. And it's being mindful of those boring chores, those things that you think, I'm not going to be mindful, I don't even like doing this. I thought of this because some of you who have been to my house for dinner know I never allow anyone to do dishes but me. I do not have a dishwasher. The reason? I've had so many insightful experiences washing dishes. I'm never going to miss the opportunity to sit with lots of suds and wash dishes. You know, that works for me. So there was this wonderful story that I read, another book I read on retreat, Great Disciples of the Buddha, wonderful book, wonderful book. And in it, they talk about this woman, Sona. And Sona and her many children is what it's called. So Sona had many, many children, 10 children. And after they started growing up a little, her husband announced, I'm going off and I'm going to be a monk. She went, oh, great. Thank you very much. And he went off and he became a monk. So she's there with her 10 children who are almost grown at this point. And as soon as they are grown, she said, you know what, I just want to have a simple life now. So all this property, he left all the property and the ranch or the farm to her. And she said, I'm going to divide it up amongst all you kids and just give me a little bit of money so I can get food and supplies. And I'm just going to sit and meditate and do walking meditation. And they said, okay. But soon the squabbling started and they weren't giving her enough money. And she was getting annoyed at the kids. And she thought this would be perfect. Does this sound familiar? And it wasn't so much fun. She was getting very annoyed, and she's getting older, and she's getting set in her ways. And she said, you know what? I've had it. I've had it with you kids. I've given you everything that you need, and you're still bickering, and you're not giving me my fair share. I'm going to go off and be a nun. Good luck to you. You got it all. I'm not having anything to do with it. So she, now as an older woman, went and joined the Buddhist nuns, the bhikkhunis. And what did she find out there? She wasn't any happier. She brought herself with her. She brought, as she said, years and years of conditioning and how she thought it should be. Anybody relate to this? And so she actually, through her meditation, saw this is what she was doing. She wanted it different than it was. She wanted things set up the way she was used to. And they weren't. And this goes back to being aware of ordinary activities. One evening, her chore, even though she was the oldest nun, she had to get all the water necessary for the meals and washing and that kind of thing and bring it, you know, from the stream back to their living quarters. And she did that. And as she's hauling it, she woke up. And there's a little in the Theragata, which is the sayings of the ancient nuns, they always write a little poem about this. So here's her poem. Then the other bhikkhunis left me alone in the convent. They had given me instructions to boil a cauldron of water. Having fetched the water, I poured it into the cauldron. I put the cauldron on the stove and sat, and then I composed my mind. I saw the aggregates, all the things that we think are us, as impermanent. I saw them suffering and non-self. Having expelled all the cankers from my heart, right there, I awakened. So it can happen in everyday life if we start paying attention and not just go on rote. So I'm going to finish up in just a moment. I'm going to skip a couple things. I usually don't write this much, but for some reason, I think it's because I was on retreat. And I was thinking about it. So gauging our practice, I think one of the best ways of gauging how our practice is doing is how are we treating others? And if you find yourself being a little bit kinder, a little more patient, a little more understanding, that's a good gauge of your practice, no matter how often you're sitting or what you're doing. If you're not finding that, then you should be looking at, maybe I should be reevaluating what I'm doing. Sylvia Boorstein, one of the teachers at Spirit Rock, and this is a famous saying, and I'm sure many of you have heard this, was asked by her husband years ago, "So you've been practicing meditation for many, many years. What have you gained from it?" And she said, "I'm much kinder." And he said, "That's it?" And she said, "It's made all the difference." So I think being much kinder, which is what the world certainly needs, is more kind people, caring about all other sentient beings. That is what the world needs. So perhaps the final question should be about, is your meditation working? Am I bringing a kinder person into the world? I'm going to finish. I want to read this one last thing. I'm big, as many of you have taken my courses know, into memorization. Even those of you who did not memorize the Metta Sutta, not looking at anybody in particular. In this book, as I mentioned, one of the earliest teachings of the Buddha, Gil does the translations, Gil Fronsdale, and he said there was a poem that all the monastics and all the lay people memorized, and they did it in such a meter that it became a chant. So it was very easy to bring it up at any time. Translated in English, not so much, but I think it's a sweet poem, and it's one I plan on memorizing. It's called An Auspicious Day. Don't chase the past or long for the future. The past is left behind. The future is not yet reached. Have insight into whatever phenomena are present, right where they are, not faltering, not agitated. By knowing whatever is present, one develops the mind. Ardently do what should be done today. Who knows, death may come tomorrow. There is no bargaining with mortality and his great army. Whoever dwells thus ardent, active day and night, is, says the peaceful sage, one who has an auspicious day. So we have 5 minutes. Any comments or reflections any of you would like to offer on your own practice, what you have found has worked for you or hasn't worked for you, beneficial advice, not so beneficial advice?
I just kind of reflect on that after all these years of meditating and stuff, you know. I've tried a lot of different techniques and I do different practices, and I go into one phase and then I kind of get tired of that and I go into another phase and do something different. But really it. You know, the real physical aspect is that in the mornings, it just gives me, I think Terry said, space, you know. As far as kind of advancing in terms of concentration or having little wisdoms come about or something, that happens. That still happens for me. I still go back to the basics. I mean, I go back almost every morning. Okay, where's my breath? Okay, where am I at now? You know, it's that kind of thing that I do, and I do. My world is so much more organized in my mind, and the reason for why I'm here. Mm-hmm. So that's kind of my comment on my practice.
Great, thank you.
So it's a practical question. I'll sneak in two quick ones, if that's okay. One, sometimes I find I only have 15, 20 minutes a day to meditate,
mm-hmm.
which, and you talked about the insanity, can last 15 minutes.
Mm-hmm.
So I wonder if you have any advice for that. I mean, perhaps meditating every other day for 40 minutes, I don't know. The other question is, talked about on retreats and we're talking about how it can be torture and you want to give up. You know, I had a day long with Rich a couple weeks ago, and I quit early. And I was sort of struggling with myself, you know, like, I was having a rough time, and I was like, should I go, should I not? And eventually I did end up going, and I don't know if that was the right decision, or, you know, if I gave in too easily, or if I was being compassionate with myself, I don't know.
Yeah. On your first question, I'm only talking from my point of view now, and another teacher will give you different advice, and this is, again, you have to gauge for yourself. I would go for the 40 minutes. And try that and see what happens. Notice the first, now you know, at least from my point of view, 15 minutes is going to be insane. Notice what happens. After you do this for a while, I think, you could start going back to the times when you do 15 minutes and just accept and no longer get upset over, God, it's crazy for the first 15 minutes. Okay, nothing to get upset about. No judging there. That's the way it is. But I would like to see you experience the ease of going further and realizing what's possible. Does that make sense?
Yeah, thank you.
Okay. And as far as leaving Rich's day long, I'd have to know more about exactly what took place. You know, if there was something that was said, was it in the body? Was it, you know, it could be any number of things. So I couldn't give you an answer saying, yes, you did the right thing, no, you did the wrong thing. It would take more of a discussion. But I would talk to Rich about it, because perhaps it was a topic he was bringing up, there was some resistance, I don't know. But I would definitely talk to him about it and let him know what happened.
Thank you.
Okay. Yes?
You know, I noticed today, I wasn't meditating, I was just living my life, but I think from meditating and looking at mind states,
mm-hmm.
one of my biggest character defects or flaws is when I talk to people on the phone that, like big organizations, put me on hold and ask you the same question, blah, blah, blah. I get really an asshole. And I finished with Kaiser, biggest foe. And I hate those people. God, what a bunch of, you know, after I hung up,
mm-hmm.
sometimes not when I hung up. and I was like, this mind state, it was like mental indigestion. It was like horrible. But I
but
I was
aware of it.
Yeah, this is just a mind state. And I don't
right.
know. And then later in the day, I'm walking and outside, and God, I'm so glad I'm alive.
Mm.
That passed too.
Yeah, exactly.
And, but one other thing, I've been thinking about this lately. About 55 years ago, I was about 10 years old, I'm waiting in line like for ice cream at Thrifty. And this big man, real tall, strange person, and he looked down at me and he said, you know, you can go to the moon, but you can't escape.
Wow.
Man, that was a heavy. It's true, but just what we're talking about today. You know, you can go to a beautiful retreat, you can go to and be in hell. You know.
The mango grove.
And I'll never forget that guy. Who was that? Who was that?
Amazing, 10 years old, and still that's what you remember. Wow, that's
yeah.
great. Thank you. All right, anybody else before we close up shop yet, Tim?
They're just, what amazes me just in my regular day, daily activities, little reminders that come along the way, and they may be memories, just in fact, but if I'm aware, if I pay attention to those little memories, they are like little light bulbs going on, so, hey, John, wake up, remember.
Exactly.
And one of the things that keeps popping up in my life is, and this will be familiar to a lot of people in this room, Desiderata, which begins,
mm-hmm.
go placidly amidst the noise and haste, and remember what peace there may be in silence.
Exactly.
And these are little reminders always that I hear and I go, oh, remember.
You know, and I didn't have time to get into all of this, but Stephen Batchelor talks about that, the aesthetics of poetry, you know, and how that can settle the mind. I unfortunately couldn't go into a lot of things, and when the mind is agitated too, poetry or ritual. Ritual. I always have mala beads, not to look like a Buddhist, but if I get agitated or I'm sitting and it's just not working, I will take these, and it's grounding just to feel that's there. It breaks that concrete state of mind. Okay, I'm back. And that works for me. You know, it might not work for somebody else. Poetry might work for you and not work for somebody else. I think it's we be open to what calms us, what enables us to be present and to start letting go. And that's our journey. And there's so many possibilities. All right, so do a final, very short metta. May our practice tonight benefit all living beings. May we in this room, and may every living being, know the taste of freedom, freedom from fear, freedom from cruelty, and the ability to live life happily and with joy. May this be so, and may we all enjoy the rest of our lives for as long as they might last. So thank you all for